There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. This is our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of the show from Thursday, the 31st of October.
You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need me.
You used to call me on my cell phone, but now I take your call on my Apple Watch.
And that's because the big takeaway from Apple earnings overnight was that while smartphone sales are down 9% year on year, wearables are up more than 54% to be precise. Watch is part of it. Earphones, earbuds, AirPods, call them what you will, another big part of it. Service is also doing well for Apple, making money on the App Store, making money on music subscriptions, that kind of thing.
Also, the phones themselves. Tim Cook says that, you know, actually the declines in iPhone sales are actually slowing thanks to the latest model, the iPhone 11. He said, it's early, but the trends look pretty good. We are bullish, again, on the phone market after a couple of years, really, of falling sales.
Yeah, I think it was only 10 days of the iPhone 11 sales that have actually weighed into this quarter's earnings. And a lot of analysts really like the lower price of some of the options that Apple users now have. There have been anecdotal reports of more having to be made, having to be shipped, suggestions that we are seeing a huge demand for this phone. So people are going to be watching the next earnings to come out from Apple, particularly slowly because of the iPhone 11 and also because of Christmas, because people buy, I don't know who these people are who get iPhones for Christmas, lucky them. But apparently it is, the holiday season is a great season for Apple and its gear.
Hence Apple shares rising. They've had a cracking run so far this year. Back in about February, March, when there was a lot of concern that maybe the Apple was running out of steam, the shares were about $150 each. Now they're closer to $250. So they'd already had a cracking run over 6 months and still they gained.
Samsung, the world's top maker of memory chips and smartphones, said operating profit there, this is out this morning, is about 7.8 trillion won, which is, what, $6.5 billion, something like that. Profit has slumped on year for four consecutive quarters, rather like Apple. They say that the chip market is struggling at the moment, but should pick up in 2020. And likewise, smartphone sales are doing okay. They've been doing a lot of advertising, more advertising than Apple has until recently, and their results are pretty good.
Well, we've been getting a bit of a local take on what's happening here. Nabila Papal is Senior Research Manager for this region at the Devices Group, so the people who look at phones, at the research company IDC. We've spoken to her about what's happening with iPhone sales, down 9% globally, and asked her, what are we seeing in the UAE and the wider region?
There's a lot happening. Overall, consumers are spending a lot less here. Consumer disposable income, they're just being more careful with their money. And overall, in addition to that, they're keeping their smartphones much longer. So the refresh cycle has really lengthened. But yes, having said that, the new Apple phones have done, you know, tremendously well. The feedback from all over the market is that they're, you know, the strategy that Apple approached with having one low end and then the two high end ones, I think it's just worked really well for them and they've had good feedback.
Straw poll on the studio, are we keeping our phones longer? I certainly am, actually. Yes. You guys?
I'm 2 years. Was I ever more frequent than 2 years? Maybe.
What about self-branders?
I keep it till it breaks. It's always been my strategy and it's not changing. We did dig into that a little bit more, though, with Nabila asking her how often is she seeing people change their phones?
Yeah. 6 months to a year in UAE. So I don't. So it was 1.5 million smartphones shipped in a quarter. And now that's come down to, last year was something about 800,000. So you can see.
Wow.
A quarter. So that was probably the lowest, right? And then now it's picked up slightly back to about a million a quarter. So going, if you look at it annually, from 6 million, you're on about 4 million smartphones.
Plus, speaking of disposable income and what people actually have to spend, we've also been looking at one of our big headline stories, which is overnight, while you were sleeping, the Fed had some good news for people who own or are thinking of buying a property here in the UAE.
And that's because they've cut interest rates for the third time, only by a quarter of 1%, but it does all mount up. This is Jerome Powell. He's the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And essentially, the message was everyone expected the interest rate cut last night. What they were looking at was any indications about the future direction of interest rates. And he very much suggested, well, that's your lot. We don't plan to cut them or raise them anytime soon. This is what he had to say.
So you asked what it would take to move, and we'll be looking at a full range of data about the economy and about the risks to the outlook. And I've given you a sense of what our outlook is. It's for moderate growth, a strong labor market, and inflation near our 2% objective. If something happens to cause us to materially reassess that outlook, that's what would cause us to change our views.
This is what Tim Fox, Chief Economist of Emirates NBD, had to say in reaction to that decision.
The Fed cut interest rates by a further quarter of 1% overnight, as the markets had been expecting, taking the policy band to 1.5 to 1.7%. That was the third successive quarter point reduction, but it does seem that the Fed is also seeking to draw the line under further easing for the time being. The statement removed some key parts of its previous pledges to act as appropriate to sustain the expansion, replacing it with a promise to assess the data and the appropriate path of the target range for the federal funds rate. Chair Powell said that we believe the monetary policy is in a good place and will act as appropriate to, as long as incoming information about the economy remains broadly consistent with our outlook.
And Tim also spoke to us about the effect on US GDP. Of course, there have been new numbers.
I think to support the decision to, or the indication that they're going to keep interest rates steady for a little while now, we had data out as well from the US yesterday, which showed a stronger than expected performance in Q3. GDP for Q3 rose 1.9%. That was only down a little bit from 2% in Q2. Also, the core inflation rate rose up to 2.2% from 1.9%. So I think overall, stronger than expected data adds to the argument that the Fed made in favor of pausing monetary policy cuts for now, having just cut rates by a further 25 basis points.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We talk real estate. Delighted to be joined in the studio by, first of all, Lynette Abad, Director of Data and Research at Property Finder. And you brought a friend, Andrew Collins, who is an advisor to Smart Dubai. Andrew, hello. The big real estate story of the week was kicked off by real estate magnate Hussein Sajwani, who said Dubai should pause residential building for up to 18 months to rebalance the market. He's the chairman of DMAC. He was speaking to Bloomberg Television, saying that while Dubai's property market fundamentals remain strong long term, he's very enthusiastic, there is a short term supply issue. This is him speaking to Bloomberg.
If they ask me, and they did ask me as part of it, my answer is very simple. Stop the supply, not forever, for a year, for 18 months.
Hussein Sajwani there referring to the real estate committee that was set up in early September to do just that, regulate the supply of new projects. Lynette, I know you were watching this closely. What did you make of it?
Oh, it's been quite an interesting week, to say the least. Look, I mean, this is a free enterprise system. We can't, in my personal opinion, stop construction for any period of time. DMAC, they just recently, over the last few years, released DMAC Hills with over 10,000 units. So it's a very large scale project. The fact that they've scaled back and they're not purchasing any more land. And I believe he said in that interview that they've cut construction by 90%. Is that correct?
He said certainly it's only one new project a year, whereas previously it was four, five, six or more projects a year that they were announcing.
Right. I mean, look, for DMAC, if that is what works for their current business plan, then that's fine. But again, they just released DMAC Hills, over 10,000 units, which put a huge supply within the Dubai land area. so again, to halt or freeze supply, again, this is a free enterprise system. I don't see how that would work here.
Andrew, I know you were watching this one closely because essentially the point Hussein Sajwani is making about supply and oversupply in the Dubai real estate market, just to recap, you've signed a deal with Property Finder to look more closely at the data on transactions and other issues within Dubai real estate. You say that having better data will perhaps help to prevent these oversupply issues happening in the future.
Yeah. So there are really useful government data sources, of course, but in the modern age with data-driven businesses like Property Finder who want to form partnerships with us, then we have the opportunity to use their data, which comes on a day-by-day basis and that allows for that much more detailed and granular picture of supply and demand. And what we really want to do is to put those two sources together so that we can start to have more informed policy discussions. And if we cast our minds back 10 years ago, then Dubai was sort of reeling from the 2008 financial crash and the property market as a significant part of the Dubai economy was affected by that. What we want to do in the future through having arrangements of this kind with Property Finder and using their data in the way that we propose to is to make sure that we can approach those situations with more confidence than we have in the past.
What are we looking at for supply still to come in at the end of this year and into next year, Lynette?
So far this year, according to the stats that we have at Property Finder, which is taken from public and private sources, freehold and non-freehold, there's been a total of 37,000 units completed this year. And now if you compare that to last year, there was about 30,000. And the years before that, like the 2-3 years before that, it hovered around 15,000 year on year. So obviously there's been a significant amount of supply that's come into the market, which has eased on prices, which has been a very good scenario for first-time buyers as well as renters. Next year, so that's what has been delivered. Now, if you look at what's in the pipeline, what is 95% plus completed as of today, we have a little over 30,000 units in that space. So we're looking to next year, I'm going to say that we will have much more than 30,000 units delivered. And in the pipeline down to 2023, there's about 180,000 units under construction.
180,000. What, over the next 3 years?
Yeah.
Better. So we could be seeing about 60,000 units a year.
Exactly.
Whereas only 3 years ago, we were getting 15,000 units a year. Of those 180,000, how many do you think will actually be delivered?
Less than half.
Less than half.
Correct.
So we're looking probably over the next 3 years at 30,000 a year.
Yeah. Exactly.
Still a significant supply.
Yes. But again, I mean, if you look at the stats over the last year, so currently we've transacted on over 30,000 properties. This is both in the secondary and off-plan market. 58% of the sales are in the off-plan market. We've had more transactions this year than we've had last year. So the sentiment is there. People are buying, investors, end users, first-time home buyers. The fact that new supply has come into the market has put pressure on prices, which has allowed people to climb onto the property ladder and buy.
And which first renters will be hearing the numbers you've just said and thinking, excellent. Mm-hmm. So will those looking at getting onto the market. Mm-hmm. For people who already own properties and for landlords, though, I mean, this isn't great.
No. However, if you look at the average yields here in Dubai, we're still higher than any other modern city in the world. We hover around 6% gross yields. So yes, of course. But you know, the investors, they've had a very good time here in the market over the last few years. And whenever you're buying property, it's never for a short term outlook. It's always for long term.
We'll have to leave it there. Fascinating discussion. Lynette Abad, Director of Data and Research at Property Finder, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your new tie-up with Smart Dubai advisor Andrew Collins. It's been great having you in the studio.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
The Qantas Engineers Union has called on the airline to ground its entire fleet of Boeing 737s after they've discovered a structural crack on the second of its aircraft overnight, which is not a good look. You don't want these things, the wings falling off. The cracks.
That would be a massive understatement, I think, Malcolm Taylor.
The cracks on its jets are on the pickle forks.
Sorry?
They're on the pickle forks.
Obviously.
The pickle forks, apparently, are the bits that attach the wings to the body. I suppose the bits that flare out as you come in from the wing, where the engines are, the drive you bit, into the body. It's the bit that attaches that. So that's a wrong place to have cracks, really. Whether it's metal fatigue, whether the older ones. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but the ones that were checked were very much the older ones. These ones are not necessarily old. Qantas says that they don't immediately compromise safety, but the engineers union is calling on the airline to pull them out of the skies. Would you go against your engineers' union?
I'd probably go with the engineers.
We'll be
I'm risk averse as a person.
Yeah.
My newsmaker this morning, slightly less a matter of life and death, is US former President Barack Obama. He's been giving a speech at, interestingly, the Obama Foundation Summit. And he's been calling out culture.
Okay.
Is what he has done. He's been calling out basically people shooting each other down on Twitter and other forms of social media. This is what he had to say. Listen to this.
I do get a sense sometimes now among certain young people, and this is accelerated by social media, there is this sense sometimes of the way of me making change is to be as judgmental as possible about other people. And that's enough. Like if I tweet or hashtag about how you didn't do something right or used the word wrong verb, or then I can sit back and feel pretty good about myself. Because, man, you see how woke I was? I called you out. You know, that's not activism. That's not bringing about change. If all you're doing is casting stones, you're probably not going to get that far.
There you go. President Barack Obama, stop calling people out on Twitter.
Some very sensible words then. My goodness, didn't he sound presidential?
Did you see the mashup? And to be fair, it was Tom Erker from The Agenda who showed it to me yesterday.
Yes.
Contrasting the, I don't want to go into too much detail, but the announcements by Barack Obama when Osama bin Laden was killed and the recent developments that President Donald Trump announced.
It's a classic.
It is an absolute classic.
Just as a linked story, to talk about sort of vehement and sort of slightly unpleasant messages, Twitter is to ban all political advertising worldwide, saying that the reach of such messages should be earned and not bought. Donald Trump and the Republicans have come out against it. The Democrats in the States have largely been positive about the move.
It totally throws down the gauntlet for Facebook, though, doesn't it? Which had better than expected earnings yesterday. People were a little bit worried about Facebook's earnings, and they have done okay. But they are where the big furore about political advertisements, after they've said that they're basically not fact-checking political advertisements, and people like Elizabeth Warren have then gone and taken out a political advertisement saying anything they want.
And that's an important point because, I mean, Twitter's got, what, 126 million daily users, Facebook, 1.63 billion daily users in September.
So, yeah, I mean, Facebook's come out to talk about how they will protect people from false political advertising, but this goes one step further.
My newsmaker, Mubarak al-Mansouri, who's the governor of the UAE Central Bank, within a few minutes of the Fed last night cutting interest rates, the UAE did the same. So the UAE Central Bank cutting its interest rates by 25 basis points. Also, the reduced repo rate for borrowing short-term liquidity down by 25 basis points, which all means my mortgage is coming down. So happy days. But far more importantly, it means that anyone with a floating rate loan here in the UAE, and we're mainly talking about the business sector here, will see their interest rates come down. And while 0.25 point doesn't make a difference, we've had 3 now so far this year. And that does begin to move the needle. I've got the envelope out, crunched the numbers on my mortgage, my home loan. It's going to save me about 25,000, 30,000 dirhams a year,
wow,
which is not insignificant. Suddenly, that becomes meaningful. That's a chunk of a school fee. So it's not insignificant.
Do you run out and spend that, or are you going to put it aside for a rainy day when the interest rates start getting up? What are you going to do?
No, I'm not going to run out and sort of splurge this weekend. Well, I've got 25,000 dirhams. I'm going to go and buy a, I don't know, whatever. But it does make you think. It does make you think about, you know, I'm selling my car at the moment, so I'll be thinking about buying a new one. So it probably will help me justify buying an expensive car to my wife or something like that. This is J-Power. The question is, though, what's going to happen next to interest rates? Fine, they've fallen so far this year 3 times, but what's going to happen next? Well, the consensus is we're done now, because what happens in the United States happens here because of the peg to the US dollar. And J-Power said, that's it. No more cuts, no more rises. This is he speaking last night at the press conference.
So you ask what it would take to move, and we'll be looking at a full range of data about the economy and about the risks to the outlook. And I've given you a sense of what our outlook is. It's for moderate growth, a strong labor market, and inflation near our 2% objective. If something happens to cause us to materially reassess that outlook, that's what would cause us to change our views.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
I have been speaking to a man who has lots to say.
This is a publishing phenomenon, isn't it, in the non-fiction category or the business book category, which is probably my oeuvre rather than yours, but this is Mr. Manson.
Yeah, this is a guy who has written an anti-self-help book. Mark Manson is the author of the 6 million plus selling New York Times bestseller, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a... which is what we're going to be calling it this morning because this is family-friendly radio. This thing came out and it was on the New York Times bestseller list for years, actually. You might have seen it. It's also known in publishing circles as the orange book. It's the bright orange one. It is everywhere. He followed that up this year with a blue book, pale blue, called Everything Is, which is a book about hope.
I've read the second one.
I'm listening to the second one on audiobook at the moment. I didn't quite get it finished before our interview. But I have read the first one, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a, about three times now. Because it's short, partly. But also because it offers a really, really different take on dealing with life's struggles. Now, Mark spoke to me because he is in the UAE at the moment. He's going to be doing a couple of sessions on Saturday at the Sharjah International Book Fair. He's also here in Dubai tomorrow at Kinokuniya in Dubai Mall, one of my happy places, at 6 p.m. He's going to be doing a book signing Friday, tomorrow, the 1st. So I spoke to Mark about basically what it feels like to have a runaway New York Times bestseller. The Subtle Art has been called an anti-self-help book, so I began by asking Mark why he thought the world needed one. That clearly was not Mark. That was a duck. This is Mark Manson explaining why he thought the world needed an anti-self-help book.
I just thought that there was a little bit too much positivity in the world. I think, you know, we had a good 50 years where we tried the whole positive thinking thing. And statistics show that things like depression, anxiety, they're on the rise in most places. People are more pessimistic now than ever before. So I think it just, people weren't buying into it anymore. And I wanted to write a form of self-help that was a little bit more critical and a little bit more realistic about things.
Well, you certainly found your audience. You've got 2 million people reading your blog every month. The Subtle Art has sold more than 6 million copies. Why do you think that this approach has resonated with people?
I think in the internet age, people have become very cynical. The internet has exposed us to maybe a little bit too much of the world. You know, we understand how the sausage is made now, and it's not exactly comfortable or pleasant. And so I think just a message that life isn't comfortable or pleasant and will never be comfortable or pleasant all the time resonates with people because it matches what they're experiencing in their day-to-day life.
My favorite bit in your first book was what you had to say about aiming to have better problems. Can I get you to explain that idea to us?
Sure. So a lot of people, they have a problem in their life and they kind of envision this solution and in their minds, I mean, we all do this, but like in our minds, we don't realize that our solution is just going to be a better form of problem than the problem we have now. We kind of trick ourselves into believing like, man, if I could just refinance my house, then like everything would be great. Or if I could just change my career, everything would be great. I'd figure it all out. And we never figure it all out because that refinancing the house or switching the careers, that simply introduces new problems into your life that are just slightly more desirable than the previous problems. And so in this way, personal growth is really just a never-ending sequence of upgrading problems.
Well, this book is an immense success. What better problems did that bring you?
I had to get a new accountant, which was very helpful. It's success is a very strange thing in the creative world and in creative fields. On the one hand, it is what you kind of dream and desire. But on the other hand, it brings a whole new set of pressures and anxieties. You know, now I'm Mr. Big best-selling author, and I have all these expectations to live up to, and I have a lot of people investing a lot of money in me, and so I have to perform to a certain level, and these are things I didn't have before. So on the one hand, yeah, it's they're much, much better problems to have. I'm very glad that I have them, but the anxiety and stress is absolutely still there.
How have you dealt with that anxiety and stress?
I think having a good support network of people around me has been really important. I've got a close group of friends who I've had for a long time, and they, you know, they don't care what I do. I'm still like the same idiot that they've always known. And they remind me of that. And that's actually very helpful, because it's very easy to get kind of swept away in all the hype and fanfare and everything. And I try not to do that.
You talked a second ago about one of your better problems being the expectations of a follow-up. How do you even start to follow up a book as big as what many in the publishing world just call the orange book, the subtle art?
I struggled with that question for about a year, and ultimately the solution I came to was I can't try to follow it up. Any attempt to follow it up or to match its success in some ways, it's just going to lead to disappointment. So I might as well focus on creating something new and different that I'm proud of. And so that's what I did.
And the new book, The Blue Book, is subtitled A Book About Hope. It's another anti-self-help book, but it describes itself as being a book about hope. Why do you think we need hope at the moment?
Well, we always need hope. What I write about is hope is kind of a necessary psychological fuel for us. So any struggle or problem that we're going through, we need to be able to envision a better life or a better world that is possible. Otherwise, we lose all motivation. We start to despair. So hope is a very crucial part of our psychology, but a lot of the book is about maybe some of the unexpected side effects of our hopes.
Yeah, it's quite big on pain. I mean, you call pain the source of all value. What do you mean by that?
Because the only way something can feel meaningful is if we feel that we've sacrificed in some way for it. If you think about like a child that you just give everything to without making them work for it, they don't appreciate anything. It's human nature. We automatically start to take things for granted. So generally, the way we come to value things or the meaning that we find in things is proportional to the amount of sacrifice that we feel that we've given for that thing. And so in this sense, it's pain is not only inevitable, but it's actually necessary to maintain kind of a healthy, stable mental health.
Well, let's look at what you're doing next. You've got a book coming out this year with Will Smith. What can you tell us about that?
Man, Will's the best. He actually approached me a couple of years ago. He's been wanting to write a book for years now, and it's going to be about his life, but it's also, he wants to kind of mix in some of the life lessons and things that he's learned over his career. It's been a blast to write.
And how have you written it with him? I mean, have you actually sat down and written it with him?
So we sat down and we did hours and hours and hours of interviews. We just sat down and talked a lot over probably 18 months. And now at this point, I'm writing the first draft, and then we're going to sit down together and revise it together, kind of go through paragraph by paragraph, and he's going to put his voice on top of it.
So that's what's coming next from Mark Manson. Friday, tomorrow, 6 p.m, Kinokuniya in Dubai. He's going to be doing a book signing. If you've read the book and you want to go and meet him.
Thanks for listening. We're back Sunday, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.